Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It's Wednesday, March the 27th, 2024. A couple of days ago, we had a show with a guy from a business school, Rob Lalka in New Orleans. He has a new book out. It's called The Venture Alchemists, How Big Tech Turned Profits into Power. Rob seemed to think that the root of all evil in the contemporary world is the internet and big tech companies. Some people suggested that I was a little harsh with Rob. I hope not, although this seems to have become increasingly mainstream, almost a convention, more and more books and articles about how the internet is indeed killing our culture. And it's not just books and articles, it's also movies. There's a new movie out. It's out right now. It's got an early release. It'll be out globally in the fall. It's called The Cost of Convenience. It's by my guest, David Donnelly, who's joining us. He's normally based in London. He's joining us from Florida, where he's visiting his parents. David, congratulations on the film. It's called The Cost of Convenience. Are you concerned as a filmmaker or as a creative person generally that this message that the internet is at the root of many of the problems of the 2020s, it's become almost a truism, and that everyone, whether they're filmmakers or essayists or book writers, are saying the same thing?
I think during the course of making the film, we just learned that it's not necessarily the internet per se, but just our relationship with technology in general. We're not Luddites by any means. All the people that were involved in the film are technology users, are fans of technology, but really we believe the root of the problem is in the business model and the incentives versus the internet itself as a mechanism.
My old friend Roger McNamee is featured centrally in your movie. Roger has been making the argument about the problems with business models. He was an early investor in Facebook and an advisor to Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg. So he's been making this argument for 15 years.
Yep.
Why did you choose to make this movie now, given that McNamee's argument and the arguments of many have been out for so long?
Well, a lot of the documentaries that have been focused on this topic were focused on either a particular event or in one sector of what we think is a very complex problem, whether that's social media or whether that's something like covering Cambridge Analytica. What we were trying to do with the film was to show that this is something that is deep-rooted, and we have to be able to hold two things in our mind at the same time. One being that something like a social media platform or the internet in general can have very positive things, but at the same time, it can also be very harmful and be negative. We had yet to be seen anything that put together the argument connecting all these different areas, including surveillance capitalism, including social media, including business models, the way that we did, at least from a big history perspective, versus an isolated event.
You mentioned surveillance capitalism. Shoshana Zuboff is an old friend of mine. In fact, I blurbed her book, Surveillance Capitalism. Didn't she do that? I mean, she, for better or worse, seemed to make a meta argument about how the internet was killing our culture.
Yes, she makes, her book is fantastic. I consider it essential reading for anyone that wants to be able to, to understand this greater. What we do in 90 minutes is show how that's connected to all these other issues.
You're a filmmaker. You've made many documentaries. You've specialized in classical music documentaries. What does a documentary filmmaker, David, bring to this subject, which, as we've already discussed, has been addressed by many different writers and critics? What can and can't you do with a documentary film that restrict authors?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question.
What opportunities, what can you do as a filmmaker, as the maker of a documentary film, in terms of making this meta argument about surveillance capitalism and rights and addiction and many of the other points you make in the film that a writer can't make? In other words, what do you bring to the party that a writer doesn't as a filmmaker?
I understand. I think primarily there's, to really understand this issue at its depth would require reading a tremendous amount of books. I think especially younger audiences just simply aren't going to do that. I mean, every half of our cast have all written extensively about these issues. So having them summarize their arguments and also being able to understand these in one sitting, I think gives us a unique angle. This also extends to educational screenings, which we've been doing. We'll be getting fantastic feedback from educators who've been screening this to teenagers. We've actually just got Common Sense Media just approved us for 13 and over as far as an age rating. And so we're seeing younger people are understanding. Now, once somebody watches this, they're going to have a lot more questions. And we're hoping that, you know, that would stimulate some curiosity to start researching and on their own journey, which would include, of course, the age of surveillance capitalism, which would include Desucked, which Roger wrote, which would include Privacy is Power by Carissa Valise, Algorithms of Oppression by Dr. Sophia Noble. And, you know, the list goes on from Freedom to Think by Susie Allegre, all people who are in the film.
Some people might think, David, that you're writing a film warning people about the dangers of screens. And yet, when you go online, when you go to YouTube, which is still the most popular online video platform, you can watch your new film, or at least a clip of the new film, The Cost of Convenience. Is there any contradiction there, maybe even a little bit of hypocrisy, that you're using the very medium that you're criticizing?
Well, the medium itself is not what we're criticizing. It's the intention behind some of these entities, which is the focus of the film. The medium itself, which we have statements several times throughout the film, you know, we argue is neutral. It's how it's being used, particularly having information within, you know, companies knowing that it's harmful to certain people, not sharing that. It's the lack of transparency. You know, there's, I think that's the primary argument, is that something can be good and bad at the same time.
Well, let's get concrete. Let's talk about YouTube. You can watch your movie, The Cost of Convenience, or at least a clip of it on YouTube for free. Of course, companies don't exist to give stuff away for free. YouTube is a Google-owned company. What's the problem with the business? Not so much YouTube. I take your point that it's not, the problem isn't with the technology. The problem is with the business models or the companies that own these companies, the companies that own these platforms. What's the problem with the YouTube model?
Well, it's the YouTube model is that it's owned by Google, and Google as an entity originally, as you can actually, we show some different screenshots of the original paper that was written by the Google founders, which they claimed before, you know, raising all the amount of money that they did, that by having this kind of search engine, if it was to be advertising driven, then it would defeat the very purpose of what they were trying to achieve. What happened is that when the dot-com bubble burst, they started to get a lot of pressure from investors to start turning profit. And all of that pressure led to them starting to introducing advertising. The result is that it's more of an advertising engine than a search engine. And YouTube is now an extension of that model. I love these platforms, and I use them. So, you know, like I said, by no means are we saying we shouldn't use them. The concept is that, you know, let's say that, you know, you want to drive a vehicle. You have to get a license. There's, you know, a test that you have to take. You have to understand the laws. I think a lot of people are using these technologies, and because there's a lack of transparency, most people really don't understand how they work. And so an understanding of how these things work is important in order to use them wisely and also understand how they're impacting you potentially negatively and potentially having life-changing impact.
Aren't you underestimating people though, David? I mean, when they go to YouTube or Facebook, this stuff is for free. Most people aren't that stupid. They understand that these companies need to make money. All they need to do is look at the prices of the stock market to understand that Google now, I think, is valued at over $2 trillion. So they understand that they're giving something away. They get surrounded with advertising. They choose to use these platforms. What's wrong with that?
I think that if it doesn't, if you're aware of how it actually works, then you can use it wisely. But the problem is that these things that they call nudges, let's take, for example, if you're a captain of a ship and you're going to be taking a ship across a large body of water, like an ocean, for example, if you miss this compass by 1 degree, or if you're, off course by 1 degree, you could end up on a different, continent.
Or you could knock down a bridge.
Yes, yes. Sadly, yes. Thank God a majority of people are safe. But yes, there's all kinds of things that could happen as a result of that. And that's what we want people to understand, that these little innocuous seeming nudges, if they suddenly are now nudging you to maybe what kind of job, what kind of career to pursue, what neighborhood to live in, where you should be hanging out. These things over time can nudge you in completely different directions. That's what I think, and certainly I didn't understand. Remember, I'm not someone who is a techie. I am a documentary filmmaker. And when I set out for this, very much what you're watching in the film is my journey. So I'm learning as we're going through this. And so it was an exploratory process for me. I don't think that I'm necessarily stupid, and going through all of this was completely eye-opening for me. And that's the kind of stuff that I wanted the people to understand.
I was watching the movie this morning. It's very well made and very interesting. You had Roger McNamee talking about this early period in Google when the founders were faced with the dilemma of how to make money. The people had put a lot of money in to the company, venture capital investors, and they fell upon advertising. If we could rewrite history, what should they have done? These platforms are incredibly popular, incredibly efficient, the Google search engine, the YouTube video platform. What would be a better business model?
I think what would be a better business model, I mean, that is a question for someone who's possibly, a venture capitalist or who can talk much more intelligently about that than I can. But what I say would have been, I think, safer for society long term would have been more transparency. Everything from, this is something that now has its own verb. With that kind of power comes accountability. That's where I think is the disconnect. I also think that as Roger says in the film, there was a lot of opportunity for the government to regulate this earlier on, and they didn't do that. And this is, this is a bipartisan project. This is not, this is something that both sides of the aisle are understanding as an issue, as well as has impacted, people from all political parties. So I think the primary aspect is the lack of transparency. And then secondly, people, especially founders, have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to maximize profit. Totally understand that. However, if that has an impact to society, it's very negative because, you're not sharing exactly how this is impacting people or even how it works. That's where I think we start to get into some dangerous waters.
You introduced the T word, transparency, but of course every internet app, every website, every product comes with a terms of service, and the vast majority of people can't be bothered to read these things. What would be more effectively transparent? What would you like Google, for example, to tell people who come to YouTube about what this experience entails?
Susie Allegre, in her book, Freedom to Think, she's in the film. She's a fantastic human rights attorney based out of the UK. She has some specific examples of what she would like to see legally happen. And the concept behind that is that if companies are required to behave in certain ways, there wouldn't need to be so many things that we're confused about or have to click through, that, you know, this would just be considered basic human rights, digital rights. And that's where we're, you know, and it's a unique time. It's going to be complicated because we're in the midst of a revolution, and we have to start to figure out what parts of humanity we want to preserve, and, you know, what parts we're willing to, you know, to evolve to in this next kind of economy.
You say that humanity is at stake. Could you be a little bit more explicit? What element of humanity are we losing with companies like YouTube?
Well, it's not YouTube in general. It's the amount of the time,
the business model, sure. The stuff that you focus on in Cost of Convenience.
I think Dr. Hilary Cash in the film, who was the co-founder of one of America's first technology addiction centers, it's called Restart. She has this great term that she introduced me to, which I was not familiar with, and it's called limbic resonance. And the concept of limbic resonance is two people having a conversation in a safe place. They're making eye contact, and there needs to be a physical proximity for that to occur. And when that does happen, there's a hormonal exchange, and there's a natural release of different chemicals that regulates your body and your happiness and your mood. In other words, we need to have this kind of interaction. And the more screen time that we are facing, the more screen time that we're having, the more time that we're having in front of the screen, the less time we're having with these other experiences.
But are you suggesting, or are some of the guests on in your movie suggesting that we need prohibition? This reminds me in some ways of the arguments of the prohibition movement against alcohol in the late 19th, early 20th century. There clearly was some very dark aspects to alcohol, violence, and addiction, but we seem now to be reasonably comfortable with a glass of wine. We have shops where you can go and buy alcohol. Shouldn't the same be true of technology, that we are adult enough to know when to stop? Not everyone. I know in your movie you had one or two so-called digital addicts who went to clinics for digital addiction, but most of us don't fall into that dark zone. Most of us are responsible enough to know how much we can use these new technologies, in the same way as we learn to use television or the radio.
Those are all excellent points, and I think the perspective we have to look at it for is that first of all, just being adults, you know, the human brain doesn't fully develop until 25. I think, especially in the United States, once you become an adult, you know, I do believe in having access to these personal freedoms. If you're 21 and you want to drink alcohol and you go to a liquor store to buy it, you're probably going to get carded if you look like you're young. And then also, too, there's warning labels on every single bottle of wine. The same thing with cigarettes. However, very young kids at young ages are using these technologies, having no mandatory education of how they work, of how a single post could impact the rest of their life, could impact their career, could possibly cost them a job. And, you know, we freely let them experiment with this stuff without also any kind of mandatory education. So rather than, you know, increasing banning something, I'm really in favor of increasing the level of education. I think that's the most important focal point that we're trying to achieve with the film.
We're speaking with David Donnelly, the director of a very interesting new documentary, The Cost of Convenience, which is a broad economic, perhaps even existential critique of the internet economy and the way in which it watches us and creates all sorts of addictions and temptations which may not reflect well on us and makes us unhappy. One thing I can guarantee you is that there's nothing insidious about Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, their business model. They still sell physical products. The guys at Liberty don't watch you. They won't keep all your data. And it's a wonderful new publication. I want to remind everyone to Have a look at it because it will be most enlightening. I'm going to run a short feature on liberties, and then we'll be back with David Donnelly to talk more about the problems of the internet. So don't go away, anyone. We're watching you.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. You have to pay for it. That's their business model. We're talking business models in part today with my guest, David Donnelly, the director of The Cost of Convenience. Very intriguing new movie documentary about the problems of the digital economy. David, you noted to me earlier that you've got an early release of the movie and then there'll be a global release in the fall. What's the business model of a documentary movie like Cost of Convenience?
The business model in our case, well, first of all, we were independently financed, and that was all very deliberate. We got some, had some interesting conversations with agents and distributors earlier on, who very much wanted us to make some changes. And, you know, this is the version of the film that we felt was the most important and would have the most impact, and also retained the most integrity to evaluating the actual problem. And so we are releasing the direct on our website right now. And then eventually we will then go to other major platforms like Amazon and Apple, et cetera. The business model is, number one, screenings and revenue through these various platforms, starting with us being direct.
What, as a director of documentary movies, it must be quite a struggle. Your movie is beautifully put together, professionally produced. How much time and effort do you need to put into business models? I'm assuming it was rather expensive to make. How much did it cost?
I'm not sure the producers want me to share that with me. It was actually, we did it
several,
on a pretty,
I'm guessing several hundred thousand dollars.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's the, yes. Yes,
perhaps even a million.
Below a million.
Okay. Well, somewhere between probably 500,000 or.
Well, it was not. It was in the documentary world. It was on a very low budget. Well, for the level of documentaries you would see on a major streamer platform. Let's put it that way.
Let's just say that it cost you $400,000. It's beautifully put together.
Thank you.
Product. How much do you need to, how does it work in terms of revenue? You're obviously not selling advertising. You don't have the Google, YouTube, Facebook model. You don't collect data about your viewers. How do you generate revenue?
Well, for quite some time now, we've been selling to networks across the globe. So we sell territories for licensing fees for periods of time. That's number one. And then number two, revenue from sales. As we go to different platforms, then we get a share of that revenue. But the broadcast deals are still the core of the way that we do things. And that's evolving very quickly.
How are things in that business? We've done many shows about the rather destructive impact of the digital economy on all the creative industries, whether it's music or journalism or writing and filmmaking. Has the digital revolution had a corrosive impact on digital filmmaking?
I would say that I saw it was in the past sustainable to be able to make niche market films, for example, world of classical music. I think that is no longer something that in this economy is sustainable. However, this topic, which is pretty mainstream, we still will do pretty well in Europe and Asia, and hopefully in America as well. But I will say that we've had successes much more in the past with European audiences.
I know a lot of kids now are at college. They all want to study film, become filmmakers like yourself. If you had kids, would you encourage them for a life in documentary film?
I have an 8-year-old daughter, so I'm a parent, which is one of the reasons why I felt this topic was so important. Documentary film, I'm not sure. I mean, it's quite amount of sacrifices that you have to make. This particular film took us several years to make, probably 3 years of my life. A lot of risk is involved in the process. I mean, you really have to believe in what you do to pursue this line of work. And I do. And everything that we start to set out on in advance, you know, I have to ask myself, am I ready to devote several years of my life, you know, to something that ultimately might only be 90 minutes? Is it that important enough that I think I should do this? And in this case, it was yes.
You mentioned your daughter and young people, and the mission of the movie in part, and you write about it, is to educate young people. What advice would you give parents? Obviously, you'd like them to watch the movie, but what other advice when it comes to kids? Should parents discourage or even ban the use of screens for kids until they're what, 12, 14, 15?
There's various, you know, approaches to this. You know, we have Dr. John Hutton is in the film, who's a pediatrician who works a lot with children literacy. He sees a correlation between reduced screen time and increased literacy rates and better brain development. You see other people trying to set limits. I would say, I mean, my daughter is still young enough to where, you know, this is not an issue, but we've already had many conversations about this. But I think the primary thing is to have a conversation that's honest about the use of digital platforms. That's just transparent between the kid and the parent, because also parents forget the kids are always watching the parents too. And, you know, parents just like myself, we're also on our devices quite a bit. And so it's very hard to, you know, tell someone that's younger to not do something when very often the parents are doing it themselves. And it's an easy thing to understand. But I think, you know, we have serious conversations with their kids about so many things, you know, driving a car or relationships, what school to go to. This should be one of those essential conversations, because the interactions that occur digitally can have permanent impact on somebody's life. And that's what we really wanted to get across. And also, it's not equal between people. What one person sees is not going to be the same thing as what somebody else might see, even if they type in the same search elements.
You touch on this in the movie, the striking reality that some of the most powerful people in tech in Silicon Valley, where I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, send their kids to Waldorf schools where technology is actively discouraged, sometimes not allowed. What do you think that tells us about what Silicon Valley insiders know about tech?
I think, you know, it's Kara Swisher just wrote this great book called Burn Book. I don't know if you've read it yet. It just came out not too long ago.
Yeah, we did a show on it.
I was going to say, it just came out. And I just read it. And there's a quote in there by Mark Zuckerberg that I guess was already public knowledge, but I guess somehow I missed it. But something along the lines of, you know, he got caught texting or saying, somebody asking him, you know, well, why would people give up their data so easily? And he pretty much just calls everybody dumb. So, I mean, if you want to know what, you know, some of these people think of you, you can just actually look to see what they say about their consumers. You know, it's a lot of this is very public. There's not a lot of respect for the consumers. You know, I think that's the first part. The second part is, I mean, it's just a red flag. I mean, if you're making something and, you know, you don't want your own kids to be using it, maybe you should ask yourself, why is that?
What distinguishes people like Kara Swisher and Roger McNamee, both tech insiders, are also critical of tech, from people like Mark Zuckerberg? Are the Swishers and the McNamees of the world, are they simply better people?
I don't think I'm in any kind of position. I've never met Mark Zuckerberg, nor have I met Kara Swisher. I would say that I think Roger is someone who sent many letters to the board of Facebook, personal letters to Mark Zuckerberg, personal letters to Sheryl Sandberg, and he didn't get a response. And so he was someone that was concerned from, you know, much earlier before it became public. I think there's an element of guilt that, you know, that might come from having financed something that caused this kind of harm. But I don't know, you know, I do ask Roger that in the film, but I mean, I can't, you know, I can't pretend to know what's going on inside anybody's head. I don't think it's a moral high ground virtue signaling as much as it is also concerned that in the long run, this is ultimately bad for tech. It's not just that it's bad for kids or harmful to also people that are using it too often. But I think in the long run, as fast as technology moves, it creates a lot of fear. I would say that I think, you know, that is certainly an element as to why people are concerned. If Facebook is getting this out of control, Meta, well, look what's happening now with AI. And that's why in the film, you know, we end it kind of open. The concept is that it's not one particular platform. We're not saying Google is good or bad. We're not saying Facebook is good or bad. We're saying that if we can't manage these relationships effectively, then this is going to be a vicious cycle with every iteration of technology that we're not going to be able to escape. And it just keeps happening faster, these iterations, faster than regulations and faster than we can find out about it. Right now, you can see all of these people in front of Congress and everyone's grilling the founders, but you know what? It's too late. I'm not saying it's not helpful, but you know, it's a little bit too late. I mean, a lot of the damage has already been done. And now there's something else that's already happening that we need to have a conversation about. We've got to remedy this gap in chasing technology. And that's what I'm interested in. And you know, that's why we made the film.
So is the fix, and I was going to ask you whether or not the horse has already left the barn on this one, because much of what you talk about is just ingrained into our digital economy. But with AI, with the growth of virtual reality headsets, what should be happening? You mentioned education before. I always feel when people talk about education, they're really just throwing up their hands and saying, I have no idea what to do about this. So we're going to dump it on the plate of teachers who already have too much to do and are underpaid. In addition to education, what is your conclusion having made this film? Is it regulation? Is it more users self-regulating? What's the fix?
Well, I think as Roger says in the film, it's beyond an individual's control for these systematic issues. And that's, you know, systemic issues rather. That is something that requires regulation and requires companies to know that they have to abide by certain rules or else they're going to be punished, because, you know, companies that large especially are not going to take action unless it's going to affect their bottom line, which is understandable. So there does need to be an element of regulation. How much regulation and whether or not that can happen without losing, you know, competitive edges, or the fear that people have of somebody like Russia or China reaching certain levels of artificial intelligence faster than the United States. You know, those are all legitimate questions that we have to have. So regulation, sure. Education, when I say that, I don't mean teachers. I mean parents. I mean, friends. I'm talking about connecting with people and having conversations with people about these issues that everyone has in their mind that for some reason or another is still a lot of taboo. I mean, everyone's made a post maybe they were embarrassed about or feels, you know, depressed because they've been spending too much time on their phone, or has somehow felt misled by something that's happened with them on one platform or another. Somehow this is just getting to the point to where it's okay to talk about. And I think that we still need a vocabulary that is accurate. People should understand how algorithms work. They should understand the idea of surveillance capitalism. They should understand that there's the possibility that if they've got a smart car and they're sitting down driving someplace, that your body weight might be sent to an insurance company, that your TV is sending information about what you watch and how long you watch stuff. This is just stuff we need to know is happening. And ultimately, when we get to a critical mass of consumers, then we should be able to vote on how much data and how these actual transactions are occurring, so that there can be a more transparent power dynamic. That's what this is really about, is power.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm not convinced. But finally, David, what happens if none of this is done? What happens if technology continues to run amok, run ahead of the regulators, run ahead of consumers, control us, and the screens continue to be more and more addictive and ubiquitous? What becomes of us in 25 years, by the middle of the 21st century? What kind of world will we be living in?
Well, I'd like to consider myself the last of the analogs as far as a generational perspective. I grew up in a period before we really used a lot of digital technologies. And so I still can compare the world now to how it was before, you know, cell phones were ubiquitous and there was Wi-Fi, for example. There's younger generations who don't have that to compare against. This is the only worldview that they know. So if we don't start taking action and making this a popular topic in mainstream culture and making mandatory education and when it comes to how the internet works, how digital platforms work, and understanding some of these key concepts, I think what's going to happen is we're going to see an entire generation kind of become a sacrificial lamb. We're going to see these mental illness issues continue. There's going to be pervasive suicides and all the different consequences that come from not understanding how we're getting information and how we're communicating with other people.
That is the cost of inconvenience. Perhaps, David, what you're saying is that we should be more sympathetic to the idea of inconvenience. Is that fair?
That's fair.